Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
I'm Hong Anh Nguyen. I'm a writer-director, and most recently I've done a short film called Saigon Kiss.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all of... First off, I want to congratulate you on such a wonderful, a warm short film. I was touched on a lot of levels, on the story level, on the visuals, and, you know, very, you know, on the music was just phenomenal. I really enjoyed your short film. So thank you for putting something like that out there.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really love your channel. There's been a lot of artists, a lot of Vietnamese artists on your channel that I admire. And every now and then I go back to the channel just as like a great library of inspiration. So yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much for the kind words. It really inspires me to do more of these kinds of podcasts. And I think especially when we live in a world where sometimes we don't get to see the early artists, like right now, what we're seeing with somebody like you, who's arguably not just starting out, but you are sort of beginning to get traction in the business. So I appreciate you for coming on and taking a risk on me, you know, in the conversation with me.
Yes, great.
So how did you come up with the story for Saigon Kiss?
It's been a few years. So we started developing this in 2019, so before the pandemic. And it was a lot of... different puzzle pieces. So I grew up in Germany with Vietnamese parents, and I think the community of German Vietnamese, you know, they are different in size compared to the community in the US. And also I'm from Frankfurt, which means that the prominence of the community isn't as big as, let's say, for example, in Berlin, where there's a really big community. So over the years after high school, especially, I kept going back to Vietnam also by myself to build like my own connection to the country and to the language and to the culture. And especially for me, I think being queer and Vietnamese, there was just such a blank page for me, like trying to understand what does that actually mean at the intersection of my identities. Because, you know, like I grew up thinking that if I'm really like leaning into my Vietnameseness, I have to be closeted, or the other way around, you know, like if I would go to, you know, like queer spaces, I would have to like assimilate, because a lot of queer spaces that I would be part of, you know, in Germany or like, you know, other countries that I lived in, they were predominantly white, or would have not so many other queer Asian people. So I think that's the very deep root of like my intention coming to Vietnam, wanting to explore the LGBT community here. And so I spent time in Saigon, you know, learning what the community looks like. And I think from there were observations and, you know, like also just being in Saigon for a longer period of time, you know, and observing the city as someone somewhat external, because my parents are not from Saigon, they're from Hanoi and Hue. So not only didn't I grow up here, but also like we don't really have a family connection to the city. So to me, it was quite fascinating to like observe the queer scene here and the city as they transition within this like very fast paced of the urban space. And I met incredible people in the community. They were incredibly inspiring. And it kind of like gave me this sense of like, yeah, there is obviously like a very strong queerness within like any culture, I think. And like we kind of forget about that there is always queerness present in our culture because we don't see it. But just because we don't see it, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Yeah.
Now,
And
when I think about the three places that you've spent time in, Frankfurt, Saigon or Hanoi or Vietnam, and the US, I'm thinking about how different or how similar the spaces for Asian queers. Could you talk about sort of the differences and the similarities between the three places? I don't know if that's a general, too general question, but I'm curious to hear from your perspective if there's a big differences, or are people just people everywhere?
Wow, it's a big question. So let me try and see. So in Germany, yeah, like I mentioned before, I mean, when I was growing up as a teenager, I think there were very little queer spaces, and especially for lesbians or queer women like me. I think the spaces that existed and have been like existing for a long time, they predominantly are for gay men, and mostly these spaces are quite white. So I never felt like I felt in one way, okay, of course I somewhat belong to this space because I'm part of this community, but I felt like these spaces only belong, like they're really created for only one letter of the LGBTQI. And I think this is changing a lot, obviously. It's like now there's like more spaces for queer BIPOC people and all that. But definitely like when I was in the age where I needed a lot of representation and modeling to see what like kind of possibilities are out there, it wasn't there. So I think in the US, for example, 10 years ago, I was fortunate to like be part of a festival circuit along the West Coast. And we went to a lot of queer film festivals that were really diverse. And I think the history of the LGBT movement, I think like also like part of like, the intersection of, migrant and diaspora stories within that is so much longer, or like maybe not longer, but definitely stronger and more present in the US. And I think obviously there can always, we can always do better, right? But I think that was definitely a big difference between Germany and the US,
Oh, wow.
like the colorfulness and the actual diversity I felt. In many senses, I feel like Germany is behind in all areas, I think, when it comes to diversity,
Even
not
behind
just queer.
Vietnam?
I think like, I tell you what, like my experience, if when I'm walking on the street as like a person that you could read as queer, I'm not straight passing, but I'm also I'm Asian, so I feel a lot more safe in Vietnam, and the perception is that we have this perception about like, Vietnam being a conservative country, we do not have the laws and rights that protect queer people. But the amount of times I've been like verbally abused on the streets in Germany, whether it's because of my sexuality or whether it's because, of my Asian appearance, is significantly high. I mean, that has never happened to me before in Saigon. So it's interesting because like Germany does have same-sex marriage and like protects, has laws that protects queer people. But the day-to-day, I feel a lot more hostile, the environment, than compared to Saigon.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that you say that Vietnam is perceived to be more conservative. But I think you're right when you say that there's a lot more acceptance in society for all kinds of people. And maybe it's just Vietnamese people loving other Vietnamese people, or it's just less spoken, but you just don't feel that same kind of hostility, whether it's for Asian people or Asian queers. I can imagine both in Europe and the US. It's just very different. Just feels different. But we often think of Vietnam as a conservative society, but at the same time, it seems sometimes to be a little bit more understanding with these kind of journeys.
And I mean, I recognize also that, I'm in a pretty privileged position that, I can live in a city where there is a lot of, acceptance. I'm sure that like being queer in the countryside of Vietnam is different, but that's also different, like being queer in the countryside of Germany, or I'm sure in the US is also different. But yeah, that's from my experience, it's quite interesting. And when I first came to Vietnam to like get to know more about the LGBTQ community here in Saigon, I brought a lot of perceptions with me because obviously I didn't get to see that much representation. There aren't that many resources or information that is accessible to you if you don't speak Vietnamese, for example, because there doesn't have to be like, not everything has to be bilingual, especially if it's catered specifically towards Vietnamese audiences. So I always felt there is this like, perception, this Western perception that I also inherited in me, that thinking that, it's conservative, people are homophobic, all of these things. But then I arrived here and I got to know the people here in the community, and I was surprised by how rich it is, by how
Yeah.
accepting it is, how open it is,
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. I love cooking with Red Boat because it's made with only two ingredients: wild-caught anchovies and sea salt. This premium fish sauce is made in Phu Quoc, Vietnam, and bottled right here in California. You can find Red Boat at select Asian supermarkets like 99 Ranch, H Mart, and Tong Phat. When I watched the short Saigon Kiss, when I watched your short, I had this preconceived notion, and I've had it for a few years now, that it's very difficult for filmmakers that are not from Vietnam to make a movie like what you did. So I assumed that you were somebody who lived and grew up in Vietnam. And so this is one of the few times that I've watched something and I've said to myself, wow, this filmmaker tricked me. I thought that you were somebody. I was really prepared to speak Vietnamese to you tonight, today. And I'm very surprised by the expression. It feels very much like somebody from Vietnam with a just sort of like a very edgy view, edgy take on society. But nonetheless, I thought it was somebody from Vietnam. So it's incredible. Do you look at your short film and think about the voice of your head or what society is looking at? How do you view it in terms of like it being a story coming from someplace, Germany, the US, the West, Southeast Asia? Do you have that perception?
I think yeah, this is a really good question. I do, and sometimes I wish I can just dial it down, because I think sometimes, like obviously, I think about representation a lot, especially representation for queer women, which is still very like behind when we see how many like the range of films that we have that tell stories about gay men, queer men. So even when I go to queer film festivals, there's always, I feel like stories about queer women is always kind of like sidelined still. And especially when we think about representation of Vietnamese women in general, you know, in the mainstream, or the whether it's going to be, or whether it's in art house cinema, I feel like there is still a notion of like Vietnamese women suffer a lot, and there's a lot of struggle, you know. But I sometimes feel like thinking about all of these politics behind the story, yeah, enables me to just immerse myself fully into the truth of the characters, or the truth of the actual story right there that is on the page. So I kind of have to, yeah, distance myself sometimes. And then, you know, sometimes when the story takes foreground and we've done all the storytelling and we finish the film, then I can zoom back into, okay, on the bigger scale, what is the significance of portraying two queer Vietnamese women in contemporary Saigon, like an image that I felt like I really needed when growing up, and you know, trying to come to terms of yeah, with my queerness and my Vietnamese-ness, because I haven't seen it. So obviously I wanted to make something that like I was yearning for and I still think is lacking.
When I watched the short, I was thinking, how does the rest of the world get to see this? How do we all get to access these gems of a work of art? You know, it's something that, you know, we can't find it yet on YouTube or anything like that, right? I mean, so I guess the question really is, when you make something like this and it's a short, typically it could be used as a calling card for something bigger in your projects and as a sample of your style and what you're able to do. But for me, on a practical level, like, how does the rest of us get to see this stuff?
So we're really lucky that the film had a very great start into the film festival circuit. We premiered with our world premiere in Germany at the Max Ophüls Prize, and then went on for the international premiere to screen at Clermont-Ferrand in France. So there's a lot of eyeballs that got to see the film already, more than like I would have ever imagined. And now we're in the process of touring the film in the next, yeah, in the next few months. So coming up, we have our North America premiere at the Palm Springs International Short Film Festival, Short Fest. And I think, yeah, accessibility is definitely something that I also think about a lot. And I feel like I definitely just want to at one point release it for people to see and people to find, because yeah, I think I always go back to like me as a 14-year-old going on YouTube trying to find those stories, like any kind of representation, because if, you know, it's not integrated into the mainstream, I was just hoping that someone would do like on a smaller scale some DIY independent things about it. So yeah, I definitely look forward to making it accessible to just the
So
wider audience.
we'll be able to find this eventually.
Eventually, yeah,
Yeah,
definitely,
wonderful. That's
definitely.
great news to hear. How did you come up with the story?
I once rode a grab car with my mom, and she was like sitting in the front next to the driver. I was sitting in the back, and I think that the driver was like, I mean, I could read her as a queer woman, and her and my mom had like a really casual but very pleasant conversation, you know, about just how long she's been driving Grab for, and also you know, if she has a husband or not. And this driver was kind of diverting this question, you know, like a very typical Vietnamese mom auntie kind of like conversation with a stranger. And I was sitting in the back just like listening to their conversation, and I think I could feel her, the driver, look through the mirror, and we had eye contact, you know. And I just felt like, you know, what a warm but also very intimate and vulnerable and also threatening conversation that we have over the course of the short grab ride. And I felt that, you know, this is like something so fleeting. It's so intimate, it's so condensed and concentrated, but it's so fleeting that, you know, we parted ways very quickly after the ride. But I think that ride really left a feeling with me. And then it just made me realize how special it is to take grab rides in Vietnam, because you are intimate physically with a stranger, like especially if you take a grab motorbike, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you never touch. There's like a very strong physical intimacy with someone you do not know. And then that intimacy just breaks and it dissolves and it goes away after, yeah, just like a 10-minute drive or a 20-minute drive or sometimes a 5-minute drive. And I think that's like something that is very special about Saigon as a metropolis, because, you know, the sense of alienation and loneliness in big cities like New York or Tokyo is very prominent. And I, you know, was very lucky to travel a lot and also travel a lot by myself. And I felt like when I arrived in Saigon, there are 10 million people living in this city, but somewhat this sort of loneliness or, yeah, alienation that you feel, it has like a very intimate and warm quality to it. And I think it's because, you know, our main form of transport is motorbikes, and we are in such close proximity to people around us. You know, when someone like asks about directions, there is no metal box, you know, that we can hide in, but, you know, it's like a very, very human, direct life interaction that you have with a stranger on the street, and then you just go on. Yeah, so that's kind of where this the theme came from, that I just like observed from, yeah, the city, and it is always moving, you know.
The two characters are very different, but kind of, to me, the same in some way. And I won't give it away, but I do want to know, did you model these characters? How did you build these characters into who they are on screen? Because they're very unique, but they don't say much, but they're very unique. You can feel it. And I think that's the power of a good director.
Thank you. Yeah, they are partly, it's a combination. So they're partly very close to the actor's biography, because they're non-trained actors.
Wow.
So it was a way for me to just, you know, not having to ask them to dive into a character that was too far away from themselves, right? So Chuk Nyu is an incredible stunt coordinator and stunt performer, actually. So having her be a martial arts teacher, instructor was, something that she could relate to, and also fitted the theme, because I wanted every element in the film to be in constant motion, and dance and martial arts like have that quality to them. And
so Chuk Nyu is the one with the broken bike?
No, Chuk Nyu is the one who picks her up.
Picks her up, okay.
Yes. And then Vicky, so Tuong Le, who is the one with the broken bike, she's a dancer. She's never been in a short film before. She's never acted before. She is a dancer in a and performs. And yeah, like the again, she we actually we were looking for a dancer who I thought could also have a presence on screen rather than an actor who was able to dance. I thought it was more important for her to just like feel comfortable in that motion. Yeah.
How did you put this together?
The film?
Yeah, the film. How did you put it together? Yeah. Like, you had this idea, you went out and write it. And then I know you work with Jang, one of the producers, who is a really good producer in Vietnam. I've had a chance to talk to her a few times. How did you put it together?
It was quite a long journey, longer than I think like any other short film because when I came here to Saigon and I wanted to make a short here, I didn't know anyone in the film industry. It was literally just like me and my producer from Australia who's Korean Australian, Andrew. He's great. And he was like, yeah, I will support you making this film and I'll be your producer. So we came here and just like started connecting with people and like slowly over time build a network here. And we got a little bit of funding from the Goethe Institute, for example, that supported us, and other smaller grants. And then I just put a heap of money aside. And during the pandemic, it was put on ice because we thought, okay, well, if we don't know enough people in Saigon, we have to fly in people. So the idea was actually to fly in crew from overseas. And during the pandemic, yeah, the borders were closed, and I kind of like was getting antsy about waiting for the borders to open and for regulations to change. So in that time, I had great opportunity to partake in a lab in Dalat, and that's where I met Chang, our Vietnamese producer, and that's also where I met a lot of like other key crew, like Phuc, our editor, and it was kind of like the door to meeting all the people that we needed to put together a crew. And then we made it, yeah, we decided to like not have anyone from overseas and just make it entirely local. So all the people on the crew, including production and post-production, are local Vietnamese filmmakers from Saigon. And that's something that was very intimidating for me because my Vietnamese wasn't good enough at that time to be directing in Vietnamese. But then I quickly had to, you know, like brush up on that because I think it was very important to me to be able to connect with the crew in Saigon, you know, with their first language and not, you know, my broken, or like not in English, because I thought it's just smoother to me to learn Vietnamese and try my best to like communicate with them rather than them trying to decipher, you know, my directions. So, yeah, and then, you know, it was also the first time I made a short film in Vietnam. So a lot of elements were quite intimidating to me, but I think with the right people, and really the crew is so incredibly talented and has so much drive and so much motivation, and they were all very, very supportive. So I think the conditions were, after some years, just given for us to create, this film.
Yeah, and I asked that question because there's probably a lot of young people who have stories in their minds who don't know where to start, who want to go back to Vietnam to make films. And I think that we are in a space, you and I are in a space where we can give sort of this background to a black box, you know? If you're looking at film and making a movie, it's not the same as getting a guitar and writing a song and putting it on re recording. This takes a lot of people and resources. And at the level that you played at, it's like it's amazing that you got an all Vietnamese local team and it was a really good experience for you. And I'm always curious about how those things transpire because it's a very difficult thing to do when you're trying to coordinate a team of people to see your vision and to execute on your vision. And I think a lot of young people are curious because if I was starting out too, I would wonder, how do you just kind of come from another country, come into Vietnam, put a team together, and how does this all work?
Yeah, I think I was incredibly lucky to meet, first of all, Chang. She's definitely like a key to meeting everyone else or bringing everyone else on board. We had a production designer Who usually works on feature films, and Jiang was introducing me to him, and he really liked the story, so he decided he would design for us, and that was like something incredibly, I just couldn't believe it. And same with our DOP, he usually like shoots for feature films now and has really left short films behind, but again, he really liked the story, and he also came through the connection of Chang. I think one of the things that I needed to remember myself was to just like stay incredibly humble, because I mean, like, I've made short films before, but you can't just like copy paste your process from like in one country and paste that into like this country, like another country, like here in Vietnam, because permits are different, workflow is different, things just work differently, and you gotta be open to that and accept that and embrace it. Because honestly, I think the reason why Saigon Kiss is the way it is because we had a lot of liberty, but also at the same time restrictions, and I think that's something that, I also just needed to remind myself, just because this is the process, not the process that I'm like, I'm not used to this, and I'm not used to these steps or like skipping certain steps. It doesn't mean that, it has any other less quality. It's just being very adaptable to your
Yeah.
environment and regulations here, right?
Do you intend to expand it into a feature, a full-length film?
It was never the plan, and a lot of people have asked me. So right now I feel like I need to just let it rest and see what it's becoming when audience members watch it. And also, like, it was such a long process making it, because we've been, holding hands with this film since 2019. So maybe in a couple of years I'm ready to revisit it. But right now I'm like very excited to just dive into new stories and work on other things.
You know, I do want to go back to Frankfurt and Germany and the history of Vietnamese people. You had talked about that earlier in the podcast, and I can't get rid of this question. Your parents came from Hanoi to Germany in the 90s, I'm assuming,
So
or the
my mom
80s.
did, yes. Yeah, so my mom is from Hanoi. She came to East Germany in 88. My dad is from Hue. So he came to West Germany as a refugee in 78. So they met after the wall came down in
And
Germany.
I just spoke to another guest recently, and she's told me that when your parents of that generation meet in Germany and you are born, she said to me, either you have to go as as a couple, you have to go back to Vietnam if you were, you know, on a work visa or student visa. If two Vietnamese people have babies, they have to either go back to Vietnam or get an abortion. But then they later changed up the law to say that, okay, you can have a baby, but you still have to have a Vietnamese passport or citizen. So can you explain a little bit? Because it's very different in America, in the US.
Yeah,
And
sure.
hearing this was shocking to me because it just was so exacting of like the way Germany would enact these laws.
So, as far as I understand, my mom had a 4-year guest working visa. So, like in the 80s, a lot of guest workers from the Soviet countries would come to East Germany, for cheaper labor. And they were very skilled, but their stay was really limited. So the idea was that they would be able to earn some money, send it back, and then after a few years, also return back to their homeland. And my dad, like many other boat people, had an asylum seeker status because he was a boat person. And he came much earlier, almost 10 years earlier than my mom, to West Germany. So his status was different. He was able to stay permanently. And I think it's just my parents were at a place where Germany was in crazy transit. I mean, like, the wall came down, East Germany disappeared essentially as a country and just was integrated into West Germany. And so were the people, and things were just very transitional and wild. And I think because they met at that point in time, laws were just different, and their status. I mean, they were able to marry, and then my mom just my mom had her first child, my sister, and yeah, she was able to stay, and so was my dad. Like, there was no sending back. But I really think that's like a very unique window of time during that period.
And I think that if you were both on work visas, it would have been different. But because your father had a different status,
Exactly.
1978, it's a different type of status. So having you would be a citizen of Germany.
That's
But
right,
I think
yes.
if they were both, if your mother and your father were both in the same work visa status 4 years, then I think the laws would have been different, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because these are histories that we grow up with in different parts of the world, but all sharing the Vietnamese roots. But it's very different. Like who you are and who you've become is a result of like all of these things happening in your history. And it's very different from somebody like me, coming in, my parents coming in 1975 and being born in the United States. Is of course you're going to be an American citizen. That's just it's just something that we all take for granted sometimes, I think, as Americans, as Vietnamese Americans, sometimes we don't think about that. And then I hear the story of German parents who got work visas who couldn't have, you can't have a baby and have it the baby become a German citizen. It's just not something that they gave.
Absolutely. I think that's the beauty of the Vietnamese diaspora. It's so rich because we're all scattered around the whole world and having like similar yet different experiences depending on where we ended up.
And your next few stories, are they going to be in Vietnam or are they going to be set somewhere else?
I have a few, I'm working on a few stories, and yeah, some are in Vietnam because I just love still continuing. I'm still learning so much about Vietnam and Vietnamese culture. It's so rich, and I feel like I only just like scratched the surface,
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I feel like the level of inspiration that I get when I'm in Vietnam or when I read about and learn about Vietnamese history is just tremendous. But I do have also a yearning to, go back to Germany and explore stories there. And I think over time I have gotten maybe more brave to explore stories at the intersection of my identities in Germany. Whereas, like, when I was younger, I felt like there is no way they would ever allow me to put this on screen. I would never get funding for it, but luckily things are changing. It's still like a, like I said, we can always do better. There is just like the first few kind of like stories of Vietnamese Germans that are, being put out there. And there's some great colleagues of mine, that have made really good work. But I feel like it's so, you can still name it. It's less than a handful. And it doesn't correlate with the, amount of Vietnamese German people who actually live there. So there's a really big gap between like the stories that are being told, but also the people who actually the diaspora that actually lives there. So I do have a drive to go back to Germany and do that.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you these days?
I think I never saw it like that, but actually, like, when I think about it more, I think my creativity is coming from like, yeah, it's coming from like my culture, a lot of it. Like, you know, the way we always like adapt really quickly, you know, and we're very versatile as people, you know, and we can like put one thing with another thing together and make something entirely new because of the circumstances, you know, that this country had to survive and all that. There is like a very unique kind of creativity that comes out of our culture, I think. And now, you know, like modern Vietnam is this fusion between a lot of differences, like different influences. Like it's not just obviously our very long colonial history and trying to always ask ourselves, what is it that makes us Vietnamese? You know, like I feel like there's a sense of like celebrating the uniqueness of our culture. But I think we're also looking around, you know, just Asian culture, like our neighboring countries, Asian culture in general, like, you know, being more at the forefront of the mainstream. And there's a lot of influences from Korea, for example, or just, you know, other places around us. And I think that fusion is quite interesting for me to just watch and observe and see what like it like transforms into.
Is there a future for you living in Vietnam?
I really love this country just because also I feel it's easier for me for some reason.
Yeah.
Obviously, I understand that there is a lot of like, you know, me coming back with my German passport, you know, and like, you know, my language skills and all of these things. Obviously, I have like a, you know, a privileged status coming back to Vietnam, but I think more so, you know, it's really funny because I like eating rice on set. I like that, you know, the crew and the director sit on plastic chairs, you know, when we call cut. Like it's simple things that somehow makes this like really, I don't know, crazy art form very close to home, you know.
That's such a
And
special observation, you know, eating rice on set and sitting in
Yeah, and
plastic
then I
chairs.
like that, like, you know, we pray before we start the first scene and the, you know, all of these rituals that are so incredibly ingrained in our culture. I love that I get to bring this and that I love that it's integrated into, you know, our work and our creation. So those are the things that I really love about like, yeah, being in Vietnam. But I think like many people in the diaspora, like many Vikings, there will always be like this, you know, life between two places.
Yeah, there's a duality.
Exactly. So,
But you brought up something really special earlier because earlier today I was in another podcast and another show, and the host, you know, I've been back to that show a few times, and the host asked me, "Why do you think you like this identity question so much? It's why are you so focused on it?" And you said something earlier at the beginning of the podcast, something like, the intersection between Asian and queer for you is an undefined space, something like that. And for me, it's also the same. This idea of being Vietnamese or American is a third culture that's kind of undefined for me. And I can't find a way to feel fully fulfilled ever. No matter how much I go to the well and drink, I just can't find the fulfillment. And I'm almost 50. And I still can't wrap my head around the fact that I neither belong here or there. It's just a weird place to be all the time. And I think like guys like my brother who was born there, left at 6 months old. I have friends who left when they were 14. They're in their 60s or 50s now. They don't have that issue. And they don't feel alien to Vietnam, and they don't feel alien to the United States. They know I was born in Vietnam. I am Vietnamese. And maybe it's not my home now, but my identity will always be Vietnamese. But you and I, and people who are like born outside of Vietnam, have a very weird relationship with the identity of being Vietnamese.
And I think it always changes. I mean, like, I can see it now, obviously, my relationship to my Vietnameseness and my queerness, and also like the way, you know, and also my language, you know, is different now. I'm at very different coordinates than I was in 2019 before I came and worked and, you know, lived here. And I think it's almost as if, like, you know, there's, because I didn't grow up here, there's like 21 or 28 years of catching up to do.
Yeah.
Of like knowledge and education and, you know, nuances within the culture and all of these things. So I don't think that will ever stop. I think it will go on, you know, for the rest of my life probably, and just evolve into something else. It's, I don't think there will ever be like, okay, now I know what it feels like to be Vietnamese and German and queer, you know. I think, yeah, it'll be forever be in transit, and there's going to be new facets that I will discover from it and new nuances. And yeah, I think that's the beauty of it also, you know.
I agree with you. It's a beauty. It's a beauty that if we are able to embrace, it's very powerful. But for all of those, including me, who was very lost about the journey, it could be a very painful process as well.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes you feel very alone.
So, you know, I saw in the credits that Nodi was a part of this this film. And, you know, even before I saw the credits, I was really taken in by the music. How did this happen?
Yeah, I was, again, very lucky because I worked on Nodi's behind the scenes for his music video, Dohi, that features his wife, Suboy. And my colleague, Hai Anh, and I, we were doing the behind the scenes for that. And in the post-production process, I just gave our editor a folder with a bunch of music that I thought could fit the vibe, just for references in terms of atmosphere and pacing. And there were a couple of tracks by Nodi in it. And we sent him the rough cut. And I said, like, hey, would you be able to give us a permit to use this track and clear the music for us? And he was so great. He said, like, yes, I can do that, but also I can also score original music for you for this. And it was him offering. And it was great because, you know, like, I obviously really admire his music. I really love the way he just fuses, you know, the whole modern techno beats and hip hop beats with more traditional instruments and music. It's just, yeah, really encompasses the feeling of the film really well in the first place, like his style and direction of music. And then for him to offer to score original music, I was very over the moon about that. And then while he was, you know, we already had like a couple of demos for the track, for that driving scene. And he messaged me one day and said, like, hey, you know, Go Hương Thanh, you know, the Cải Lương singer, she is in town and we've collaborated before and she wants to record some new music with me. Like, do you mind having her? Do you think it's like a good fit to have her sing on the score? And I just couldn't believe that, you know, like having such an incredible icon, you know, agreeing to be part of the soundtrack. So that was amazing. Yeah. So that was Nodi, but we have like so much other music, right? So we have that part, and then we have the Trịnh Công Sơn song, Một Cõi Đi Về, which was actually, a song that I really wanted from the very beginning when we were in really early stages. Because I think, like, you know, as Vicky in general, you just like grow up with music from that era because you remember your, like, my parents putting it on and all that. So I think there is this like nostalgic video element there that, you know, I decided to use a Trịnh Công Sơn song. But then people were saying, like, well, it's going to be really difficult for you to get the rights. You know, good luck with that.
And were you able to clear it?
Yes, like, it was a long process. But, you know, like, We had, again, we just were so lucky to work with incredible people who knew the Jin Gong Sun family. And, I then just sent them, like my reasoning why this song is so fitting for the characters and for the film and the significance of it. And they were really supportive. They were like, yeah, we want to support you. And we'll give you the rights and you can clear it. And so we recorded the track with the really great musicians in town in the studio. And then we had, for the dance scene, we had a local DJ called Mess remix it again. And Mess is incredible. She's also friends with Nodi, and she plays all sorts of Vietnamese instruments. So she would record them and like mix them with a beat and like make a kind of like more modern version of it. And then for the end of the film, we just use the pure instrumental. Yeah. So I'm really proud. I'm really proud of the music in the film. Yeah.
It's amazing. I soundtracks make a huge part of any movie experience, and I think that this situation, this is a prime example of, something going really good, and then it just pops it and elevates it to another level.
Absolutely. And I just really love this like generational bridging that like happened in this whole process of working on the music. Like we had Hương Thang, Cô Hương Thang, and then the family of Trịnh Công Sơn, that really like senior generation, and then like all the youngsters like Nodi and Mess and me trying to like make a version and like have like a musical package that was complementing the film. It was just a very incredible part of post-production.
When I think about you as a filmmaker, I think about the dreams I had of becoming a screenwriter, making movies in Vietnam, perhaps one day directing. I just never had the courage. And thank God I didn't do it yet, because what I started to talk about to you was it's very difficult for a Vietnamese American or Vietnamese, overseas, Việt Kiều, to go back and try to make a movie like Trấn Thành. I don't know if you've watched Mai or Nhà Bà
Yeah.
Nữ or Bố Già. It's almost impossible for you to go home to Vietnam and try to make something that connects with people there, because our spirit and our outlook is very, very different. Our sensibilities are very different. And that's why I was like, I tip my hat off to you. I really salute you and applaud the work that you did with A Saigon Kiss, because somehow there is an emergence of that feeling very authentically being somebody who understands the culture in a very quiet way.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a huge compliment. But I also think at the same time, maybe a person from Saigon, maybe a queer woman from Saigon would tell me, wow, this film is like told from such an external perspective.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
We haven't had the chance to screen it in Saigon yet, but
That's
I
a
think I
good
have
point. I didn't
come.
think about that. That's a very good point,
Yeah,
because I'm
I
not.
think. Yeah, for someone in the diaspora to see two characters that are portrayed as, their local characters, it's not their narrative per se is not a diaspora story, about struggling about their diaspora identity. But I still have a feeling that like if someone local would watch this, they would probably see that it's not,
Not real, not
it's not
practically.
an made by a
What?
local person. And I think that's like something I really can like I'm happy to accept and come to terms with it, because it's like how people ask me, do you think you will ever be able to tell, like, are you interested in telling stories that are about straight people or anything like that? And I'm like, yes, but I mean, I can't shut down this big part of my identity that I'm queer. So things and stories will always come through like a specific lens when I tell them, and it's the same with like my Vietkioness, I guess. Like I can tell I can tell a story that is local and the film is made by local Vietnamese people, but because it's through my lens, I can't. There will always be this quality that it's from an external perspective, and maybe the level of it kind of like ranges. Sometimes it's more obvious that's like, someone external, or sometimes it's just like hidden, yeah, or less.
This is like that AI question where like at what point do you not know it's AI talking to you? You know, at what point do
True.
we know that the film director is not from Vietnam or is from Vietnam, you know? And getting into the meta level of all of this is funny because why does it even matter, right? Why
I
does this
know, yeah,
even,
I think that's, yeah, for sure.
you know, why does it even matter? Why does authenticity matter? Well, it kind of does matter because you're kind of like expressing a viewpoint that is you're trying to connect, but also be different, funny, dark, you know, moody, or whatever you're trying to do. You're trying to make it creatively stand out and be special, but at the same time universal to the people, the native, the local feeling as at the same time. So I never stopped to think, I am not a queer Asian woman, so I don't see that piece as something that is something another Asian woman, a Vietnamese queer woman would see it and go, no, this is not how we do it.
I think definitely, when we showed the film in Germany, a lot of the questions is always like, this is clearly based on your own experience, you as like an international student. Like for the German audience, they cannot fathom that this was actually, it's a story set in Vietnam about Vietnamese people, but it wasn't told by someone who didn't grow up there. Like it was incredibly hard for them to understand that, and I was always challenged in Q&As about this element. And like in Saigon, it's probably going to be very different, the perception of it, but I think also sometimes, yeah, I lose my patience sometimes, with always having to position my voice, in this whole, network of, how close or how far I can be from, the source material. But I am quite aware. One of these like fears that I have is like I'm someone who is from Vietnam. Yes, I didn't grow up there, but also my family is not from Saigon. And for me to have the name Saigon in my film title, I thought I'm very aware that like, this is maybe like a risky move, or like a lot of people would disagree with that choice,
Well, let's get into it. I'm wondering what were the consequences, the repercussions? What was the feelings of other people, advisors on the ground, such as Jang and locals, about you naming it Saigon Kiss?
I think the one saving grace definitely is that like Saigon Kiss is a like standalone term. It refers to the burn that you get when you get burned by the exhaust of the motorbike. So it's often referred to as a Saigon Kiss, that little burn. So to me, that term kind of just like tied into the themes of the story, and I thought it was like fitting, and so I thought, that's my justification, right? It's not because I wanted to use the city's name. It's just because I wanted to use that specific term, yeah, that was already established
Makes
by,
perfect sense. So, do you mind talking about censorship? Are you at our liberty to talk about censorship? Because,
Sure,
well, I mean, we can be very careful because I want to be respectful to, you know, I want to be respectful to, like, you just don't go to your uncle's house and do whatever you want, right? You
Yes.
don't go to your aunt's house and you do whatever you
I
want.
appreciate that. Yes.
Right? That's how I always look at Vietnam. Like, I'm going to somebody's house. I have no right to want to do what I want at somebody's house. There's rules at somebody's house. So I want to be sensitive that you and I both work at another person's house and we come visit the other house, their family, but it's not our house. So that being said, I do want to, you know, ask how it was received in terms of censorship or the name Saigon Kiss.
We don't know yet because it hasn't screened here. So like there are, we don't know. We obviously shot with a film permit and all the, you know, legal aspects during production and all that. But then there's many different stages of getting approval and all that. So obviously the last stage is screening it here. And we just haven't crossed that bridge yet. And I was told, you know, by many more senior filmmakers that like, just don't think about that because, you know, you don't want, you just adapt once you cross that bridge. And
make
we haven't
the
crossed
movie
it
you
yet.
Want. Yeah, make the movie you want and let it deal with itself.
Exactly. Because you don't want to like censor things in advance and actually like not knowing whether it would have passed or not, right? You should just like do your film. And then once you get to that stage, there will always be like a negotiation, I think, like of whether it gets entirely banned, whether it you have to cut scenes and all that. So you will know at that stage, when there is a list, what kind of adaptations you are willing to make and all that. But yeah, we haven't gotten there yet. And to be fair, I think censorship like is something, you know, I'm very lucky to be a filmmaker who, you know, for example, if it doesn't get screened in Vietnam, I do have the privilege to like screen it anywhere else in the world, right? I don't get like, because my passport is not Vietnamese, the precautions are differently than like my Vietnamese local colleagues, for example. So I feel like the gravity of censorship, I'm maybe not in the position to acknowledge or talk about as opposed to my local colleagues, because it's different consequences.
Fair enough. That's a really interesting answer. And I think it's, it's something that we deal with in a very different way than the locals. And, you know, we are granted a different type of privilege to do the things that we want to do. But I always say we're visiting relative's house, and we just need to be respectful. And I really appreciate, you know, all that you've shared today. It's, you know, being able to understand three different sort of cultures, you know, the German culture a little bit and the Vietnamese, and then, you know, your understanding of the US culture helps me see, you know, how this story was put together. And it's very fascinating.
Thank you so much for this conversation. Yeah, I really enjoyed being part of this and talking to you.
And I hope to see you soon, whether it's at another film festival or Sundance or, you know, somewhere in the world. I'm sure we're going to run into each other. So thank you so much.
Yeah,
Kate.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.